Maine CDC Director Dr. Nirav Shah. Pockets of Maine have seen alarming outbreaks of COVID-19 this past week, including Sanford in York County and Rumford in Oxford County. Public health officials say this demonstrates that community spread is happening in those places and advise extreme caution. Meantime, the summer tourism season is coming to a close, and hotels and restaurants in tourist hotspots seem to have handled the surge of visitors safely, with very few cases reported. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, Dr. Nirav Shah of the Maine CDC joins us to discuss recent outbreaks of COVID-19 and the state's response. He'll also answer your questions about testing, contact tracing, and the latest medical research about the virus. What do you want to ask Dr. Shah? Maine Calling is next, but first, this news update. For Maine Public Radio, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. The recent upward surge of COVID-19 cases in Maine has today's guest, Dr. Nirav Shah, concerned. We will talk about the latest outbreaks in York and Oxford counties, how schools and colleges are doing, the state of summer tourism, and what's in store for the colder months ahead. Joining us, Dr. Nirav Shah, who is director of Maine's Center for Disease Control and Prevention. This is about your questions for him. What are your questions about the new relaxed testing requirements or about the treatment of the virus or the vaccine? You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, post a comment to our Facebook page, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. And I just want to make a note here. When I say brief email, we have so many questions coming in that I will not read a long email or Facebook post. So a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org or a comment to our Facebook page needs to be brief. Dr. Shah, thank you so much for being on Maine Calling again. I really appreciate you taking the time. And why don't we start with the latest? There has been a concerning surge over the last week in York County, especially in the Sanford area. What is the very latest on that?
Well, Jennifer, thank you so much for having me on again. It's an honor and a delight to be able to chat with everybody. And you are right. We remain deeply concerned about the uptick in COVID-19 cases in and around York County, particularly in the Sanford area. About a week ago, roughly half, if not 60% of all the new cases every day on a daily basis that were detected in Maine were coming out of York County. That trend continued. Thankfully, as of today, the percentage of new cases in Maine from York County has fallen a bit from around 50 to 60% down to about 30%, but still accounting for the highest number of new cases on a population-adjusted basis. There are a lot of reasons why that's happening, and we can talk about those, but I think the bottom line is that for individuals who are listening, who are in York County and in and around that area, there is an ever closing window of opportunity to get a handle on and keep a lid on the COVID-19 situation there. And everyone can do their part by doing things like wearing face coverings, maintaining physical distance from one another, and staying home if you're not feeling well.
And what about in Oxford County? I understand that the cluster there is around Rumford.
That's right. Not long ago, we detected an outbreak initially associated with the ND paper mill in the Rumford area. As of right now, that outbreak has grown to about 24 cases. Given the nature of small towns in Maine, the things that make small towns great are also the things that can generate a lot of transmission of COVID-19. Close ties with your neighbors, standing by shoulder to shoulder with everyone in your community, having each other's backs, gathering for breakfast, lunch, and dinner. Those are all the things that make small town life great. I grew up in a small town, and I love those things, but they can also be great opportunities for COVID to transmit from person to person. We're seeing a little bit of both in and around that part of Oxford County and that part of Androscoggin County. Cases initially tied to the mill, we may have detected that they have also been cases transmitted outside of the mill setting as well. We're trying to understand and better characterize that, but for now, our concern level for Oxford County was sufficiently high that we moved it to the yellow designation as it relates to schools to keep kids in that area safe.
Let me ask you that about what we know about transmission now. I know that I can only imagine that in every case, there's no way to know exactly where someone has contracted COVID-19. But from what we've been able to learn over the last 6 months and the clusters that you've studied, are we talking about people who have hugged each other, people who have sat next door to each other at a picnic table? What seem to be the modes of transmission that people do in their everyday lives?
The things that seem to be most strongly associated with COVID-19 transmitting from one person to another are, they can really be boiled down to two factors. And it really all happens primarily, what we focus our concern on are gatherings. And the factors that drive transmission at gathering can be summed up in two words. One is the density of the number of people at that gathering, and the second is the duration of that gathering. If individuals are packed into a small space, especially if that space is indoors, the likelihood of transmission of COVID going up goes greatly, greatly higher, especially if those individuals are not wearing masks and the gathering in question is for a prolonged period of time, 15, 20, 30 minutes or more. Those are the prime likelihood areas for COVID-19 to be transmitted. Transmission, we have a better sense of it now than we did at the beginning of the outbreak and the pandemic. And certainly we will have an ever-evolving sense as we go on. But the contact tracing process is how we get our heads around where and how COVID is being transmitted. I'm extremely proud of the contact tracing force that we've assembled at the Maine CDC. They are the reason that we've been able to characterize so much of how the transmission in Maine is occurring.
Dr. Shaw, I want to ask you about tourism season. August was really, really busy in Maine after a slow start to the season. I know that some hotels were full for the entire month. Restaurants finally, even though they have the tables spaced apart and lots of outdoor dining, finally seeing activity. What do we know from the areas where there's concentration of tourists, places like Booth Bay Harbor, Bar Harbor, Ogunquit, the Lakes region? What are we learning about transmission there?
From a public health perspective, the news surrounding tourism in Maine is favorable and encouraging. The state of Maine, all of us, managed to go through the entire tourism season, the summer tourism season in Maine, and have virtually or very limited transmission of COVID-19 brought in by outsiders into Maine, out-of-state residents or out-of-state visitors coming into Maine, generating outbreaks. That was by far the rarity across the state. For example, if you take a look at the zip codes on MDI itself, the Bar Harbor zip code, Southwest Harbor, some of those adjacent zip codes, the number of individuals in each of those zip codes who has COVID-19 is anywhere between 1 to 5. Relative to the number of tourists that they welcomed, that's a favorable story. I think what it shows to us is that as a state, when we set our minds to doing something in a cautionary, safe, scientifically grounded manner, we can do that. We should all feel proud about the ways in which Maine was able to navigate the summer tourism season and both have a summer tourism season itself, but doing so in a way that kept people in Maine safe fundamentally.
All right, I'm going to ask you a related email. This is from Chris. Could you comment on the number of out-of-staters who came into Maine clinics with a positive test, but are counted in their home state statistics? So how many people drove into Maine, got a test here, tested positive, but that test doesn't count in Maine's numbers?
Sure. That number, so if someone was tested in Maine and declared their residence in Maine, that's a case that we would count. But we also keep track of the number of individuals who may have come here for a day and not felt well, gotten tested, and then gone back to their home state. We don't include them in our numbers because those individuals have signaled that they do not intend to stay here. There were about 10,000 such individuals who got tested. And of those 10,000 individuals, about 258 tested positive for COVID-19. That is against over 1 million tests that have been run in the state of Maine. That's the denominator we're talking about. So out of around a million tests, about 258 have been among that have been positive among out-of-staters. I know that this was an area of high concern earlier in the summer. It was something we were concerned about. But thus far, we have not detected very high levels of transmission from out-of-state individuals coming to Maine and spreading COVID-19. Indeed, the increases that we have seen in York County, Oxford County, and other parts of the state are related to individuals within Maine, not individuals from other states.
All right. I am going to read an email from William that actually represents a few that we've gotten in here. William's son is a student musician, and he writes, "All the music programs have been severely affected by your guidelines. I'm struggling to understand your decision to sign off on the Maine Principals Association guidelines for contact sports like soccer and field hockey." He says, "My issue is sports are extracurricular elective. My son does not have the option to elect not to be in class with these student athletes, which I feel puts him at higher risk of infection. There seems to be no consistency or transparency on this issue."
Well, the Maine Principals Association is the primary decision maker with respect to matters of school sports. They did solicit and we did provide input to them around manners in which to convene school sports safely. But they are the ultimate decision maker as to how those sports are convened and in what format. With respect to in-person music education, that is something that is more under the purview of the Department of Education. Similarly, our group of experts that has been advising us on matters of safety, particularly in schools, they did express some concern around, say, things like choral practice. There have been a number of outbreaks that have been linked directly to choral practice or choir practices in other venues. So it was a question for that group of balancing, again, the risks and benefits for something that was more in our purview. In this setting, given the potential risk of transmission, especially from groups that are singing, that was something that right now we didn't feel like could proceed, given the potential risks associated with it. So much of this risk depends on the background rate in the community. That's one reason why the best way to get back to all those activities is collectively for all of us to keep a lid on everything that's going on.
All right, we're going to go to a voicemail that came in before the program. This is from Carrie.
Hi, my name is Carrie. I'm calling from Cumberland, Maine. My question for Dr. Shaw is, how would you advise me on the following? I have three kids attending a hybrid model school in Cumberland County 2 days a week. They have grandparents who reside in North Carolina who want to visit us in Maine in December. The number of cases where they live is 330 for their county, with deaths numbering 7. Should I allow a visit? If I should I recommend that they fly or drive to Maine? Also, should they stay at a Portland hotel or in our house? The grandparents are approximately 72 years old. And lastly, it will likely be too cold for them to do much visiting outside, though we will try. If we wear masks and keep distance as best we can, are there other things we could do to enable this to be safer, if this is at all even something we should do? I think families are getting a lot of pressure to figure out holidays and how to navigate them, and any recommendations would be hugely appreciated. Thanks.
Well, your caller put her finger right on it, which is, as we go into the holiday season and start making plans for holidays of all different sorts, be it Thanksgiving or those in December, this question is one that is on all of our minds right now. I can't provide any specific advice to your caller, not knowing some more of the operative facts. But here are some general principles that I think we can all think about as we go into the holiday visiting season, particularly having older friends and family come to visit us. The first is, if they are not coming from any of the states that have been given an exemption to the test or quarantine requirement, one of the immutable principles is that they need to get a test before they arrive in Maine on a sample that's taken within 72 hours of their arrival. Increasingly now, such testing is more and more available. And they can do so at their doctor's office, or they can do so via their own potentially State Department of Health in the manner that Maine has set up swab hemoglobin sensites. So that's principle number one. That helps you and your family get a sense of whether they are introducing any risk to your family. But your caller asks a related set of questions. What about the risk to such visitors from your family? That risk has to be taken into account as well. So there, I think some of the best principles are, even while folks might be visiting, even if they are staying in your house, to try to have as much distance between individuals as possible, making sure that their room is cordoned off from others, making sure that if they are interacting, especially if they're indoors, doing something like wearing a mask when you have folks coming to visit, especially as in this caller's case, individuals who might be older and who may have different medical vulnerabilities. Wearing a mask, especially when indoors, can limit the likelihood that anyone in your family might unknowingly transmit COVID to visitors. The other issue that your caller brings up is the mode of travel. Something that is on everyone's minds right now, again, as we think about going out to travel, is it better to fly or is it better to drive? There is no clear answer. The risks of flying are not yet well characterized. There have been some journal articles and studies that have documented some degree of transmission on planes, but the data around how much transmission can occur in the more recent era, with everyone wearing a face covering and the middle seats being empty, those data are still coming in. So on first glance, it seems that driving is preferred. But we all know that driving doesn't necessarily entail driving straight. People stop. You might have interactions at rest stops and gas stations and hotels along the way that themselves could introduce risk. I think the best approach there is to do what is safest from an overall safety perspective. If driving entails driving late at night and folks have vision problems, then that may not be the safest route. So there is not a clear answer there, and the data around the safety of different modes of travel is still really evolving.
We'll go to Ellery, who's calling from Waterville. Hi, Ellery. Go ahead.
Hello, and thank you again for a great program. Much has been made about the proper fitting of masks and the suitable masks. I was wondering if you might be able to shed some light on another type of mask, the face shields, goggles, eyewear. I specifically work with a number of shut-ins, and I'm concerned about being the maximum protection I can. And I was wondering if you might have any more information about the viability and usefulness of goggles, face shields, and eyeglasses.
Ellery, I'm glad you raised that question. That's something that we've talked about internally a lot as we've taken a look at our guidance. Here's the bottom line. The best thing for you to wear as you are interacting with others is a combination. It's a combination of both a good, well, tight-fitting mask as well as a face shield, the type that goes over your face, down below your chin, and back behind your ears. Wearing both of those in concert with one another, the mask plus the face shield, reduces your likelihood of potentially getting infected and your likelihood of potentially infecting any of the individuals you work with. If both are not possible, the primary focus should be on the mask. The mask is where that is what is doing the bulk of the work. And in this day and age, masks are increasingly common. You don't need to have a hospital-grade N95 or surgical mask. Even a good, well-made cloth face covering plus a face shield is a great combo. And that should be something nowadays that is well within everyone's reach.
All right, Ellery, thanks so much for your question. We are going to take a quick break. We're talking with Maine CDC Director Nirav Shah. When we come back, more of your comments and questions. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from Central Maine Power, committed to a clean energy future for Maine. Learn more at poweronmaine.com. And the University of Maine at Augusta, committed to providing a quality, affordable education online and in the classroom. UMA.edu.
President Trump has attacked his opponent's political record.
Joe Biden has been on the wrong side of history for 47 years.
Biden says four more years of Trump would mean chaos.
You are not safer in Donald Trump's America.
I'm Audie Cornish. Join NPR Tuesday night for special live coverage of the first presidential debate from NPR News.
Tuesday evening at 9 on both Maine Public Radio and Maine Public Television. Join Maine Public, the Nature Conservancy in Maine, the Maine Education Association, and the Maine Mathematics and Science Alliance for a special lecture series around our collective relationship with the natural world around us. We are presenting free online Zoom lectures inspired by the PBS documentary The Age of Nature, exploring how humans have shaped and affected Maine's rivers, forests, and ocean. Register now at mainepublic.org. Please click on the Events tab. Our next lecture, Flow, The Ripple Effect of Restoring the Nature of Rivers in Maine, is this Thursday at noon, and the featured speaker is Laura Rose Day, President and CEO, Seven Lakes Alliance. Please register now for this lecture and also for invites to the Rivers Lecture and Ocean Lectures that follow, again at mainepublic.org. Click on Events.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. Today on the program, we are talking with Maine CDC Director Dr. Nirav Shah about the latest on COVID-19 and its spread in Maine. We invite you to be part of the conversation. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, post a comment to our Facebook page, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. A tweet here from Susie. Do contact tracers ask if people they contact had attended any large group gatherings as a matter of routine?
The answer there is yes. Contact tracers follow a script, so we can make sure we're asking everybody all the right questions. And yes, one of the questions that our contact tracers at Maine CDC do go over is whether you've had, in general, any type of exposure. And we know that one of those types of exposures can be any kind of large congregate gathering. And we're not interested in the purpose of that gathering. We're just interested in whether you may have attended such a gathering so we can better help characterize what your risk of transmitting COVID to others may have been.
And how does that work, Dr. Shah? If someone has been diagnosed with a positive test and they've spoken with a contact tracer, does the CDC then identify everyone that person has come in contact with, or is that person asked to call people that he or she may have come in contact with?
I'm really glad you raised that. The contact tracing process is divided into two distinct pieces. One piece tries to help you, the person who got COVID-19, figure out where you might have gotten it from. And for that, that's where we ask about where you've been and what type of activities you've engaged in. But we also use contact tracing as a key piece of preventing other individuals from getting COVID-19. So for that piece, we ask you, everyone you may have given it to, downstream questions. In that connection, we ask individuals, everyone that they have come into contact with over the time that they may have been transmitting COVID-19. Maine CDC then takes those names and phone numbers and contact information pieces, and we reach out to those close contacts. We don't tell those close contacts who gave us their name. That confidentiality is absolutely maintained. So when individuals get a call from Maine CDC, they shouldn't feel sheepish or shy about sharing with us the names of their close contacts, because we will not share the person who gave us those names when we call those individuals. We take privacy really seriously. And even in the midst of a pandemic, you don't lose your right to privacy.
Are you counting on people to be honest with no way of enforcing that? Are you counting on people's goodwill when they have a positive test that they will indeed give you a complete list and be upfront?
We do, and what we've seen, not just in Maine but nationwide, is that people want to do the right thing here. Bear in mind that your close contacts are most likely the people that you care the most about. So there's not a lot of incentive for folks to hide who they may have been in contact with, because those are the people that are the most likely to get COVID and simultaneously the ones who need to be warned. So we do rely on people's good intentions here, but what we have seen over and over again, not just with COVID contact tracing, but other infectious diseases like TB and stretching back even beyond that over back to measles, is that folks want to do the right thing in order to keep other people safe. There is simply too much at stake when it comes to things like COVID-19. So what we have found is that folks want to share all of their close contacts. They may not remember all of their close contacts on the first phone call, and that's why we have multiple phone calls with individuals, because as with all of us, you may remember, I did actually have coffee with Bob last week, and I do need to remember to tell Maine CDC that. So we don't need every name on day one. We allow for the fact that recollection comes back in pieces, and when folks remember things, they can let us know, and then we'll reach out to those individuals.
Kim on Facebook asks, are we seeing any cases of regular flu yet?
The flu season in Maine has just started, and we are starting to see reports of influenza. I urge everyone to take a look at our latest flu reports. We publish them on our website. You can Google Maine CDC influenza report, and you'll get a snapshot of what we know with respect to influenza. And of course, as we go into the winter, we are starting to see some cases of the flu. We expect that it will pick up as it has in every other year. This is a good opportunity, though, to remind everyone that now is the time to start getting your flu shot. If you have not gotten your flu shot yet, this is a great time and opportunity to do so. As we go into the fall, as we go into the winter, with flu being at our doorstep, one of the things that you don't want to be contending with is the emergence of both COVID-19 and influenza in your family. And the flu is something we've got a vaccine for. So this is a great opportunity for everybody out there to take a moment today to make plans to go get your flu shot.
We'll go to Ethan, who's calling from Saco. Hi, Ethan. Go ahead.
Hi there. How you doing? Dr. Shaw, thank you. I've been waiting for this moment for months and months to talk to you, finally. It seems very difficult to get some public interaction with you. I have some questions about the coronavirus in general, and then a couple of questions about it, about the
Ethan, I need you to be quick. We have dozens of people lined up.
Okay. Well, does it not seem like the response to the coronavirus was in itself more hazardous to the human health population of this state and nationally? And also, is the CDC backed by Big Pharma? And also, the masks seem to be, first of all, herd immunity. Why are we not trying to get herd immunity when other countries have done so? And I don't know if you took note of all these questions. Is there time for one more?
Quickly, yes, go ahead.
Okay, so the lockdown itself seemed to harm, especially by way of the fear in elderly and children, seemed to have more harm than good. And
okay,
I have
Dr.
a million
Shaw,
more questions, but thank
Ethan
you so
seems
much.
To have a lot of skepticism about the response. Were you able to get those questions all down?
Sure. I mean, Ethan, I hear where you're coming from. And we think about policy responses to COVID-19, we take into effect the potential benefits of those policies as well as the very direct impact that they may have on human health, mental health, as well as physical health. But let's start by noting that just last week, we crossed a sad threshold in the United States of 200,000 people who have died with COVID-19. And at some point today, we are likely to pass an equally, if not sadder, global threshold of 1 million people around the globe are likely to have died of COVID-19, and we're likely to pass that threshold today. So as we think about that balance, let's just keep in mind what the morbidity and the mortality has been. It's been staggering. That's more people in the United States alone that died on the battlefield in all the wars stretching back to the Korean War. So we do, of course, take into account the fact that measures to, say, limit the exposure of COVID-19 in nursing homes may mean that individuals may not be able to visit their families. And that has a very real and definite impact. So we're not oblivious to those negative consequences as we are making our policy decisions. The question here is, on balance, what is the best decision, not just for today, but what will equip us to reopen and get people, say, back into schools in a safe safe manner. Now, of course, there are those who disagree, and one of the things that makes our state great is that we've got a venue in which to have those disagreements. But the way that we go about these decisions is not one that is single-mindedly focused on one outcome. We, of course, try to balance all of these competing approaches as we're making our public health policy recommendations.
All right, Rick, thanks for your question. We'll move on to Andy calling from Portland. Hi, Andy. Go ahead.
Hi, Dr. Shaw. I read a report in the paper today about the elementary school in Lewiston, and it raised a couple red flags for me. The first was that 8 staff members are in quarantine, which seems to be mean that they must have violated the principle of cohorting that we saw in Dr. Blaisdell's camp study. And second is that it took 4 days to find out about the positive test, which seems way too long to be able to stop a new generation of spread. And the final thing is, it seems like there's no plan to immediately test all of the close contacts, as even the federal CDC finally recommended. And of course, I recognize that there could still be somebody could become positive later, but you can always do 2 rounds of testing with quarantining during the whole 14 days. So I'm just a little bit concerned that the schools just still don't seem to be getting your advice, and hope that you can address that.
Sure. Having a certain number of individuals exposed and thus being in quarantine is a measure that's taken for extreme safety. It should not be taken as evidence that best practices were routinely disregarded. Indeed, any type of school setting may necessarily involve some exposures to teachers as well as other staff members and faculty members. So the fact that there were 8 individuals who were identified as close contacts, again, is not evidence that there was systematic non-compliance with public health protocols. Now, testing of individuals who were exposed and close contacts is something that we do recommend. It's something that we've recommended since day one. This is not a new recommendation for us at all. Indeed, just this past Friday and Saturday, we worked with an entity to offer testing to everybody in and around the Sanford High School community after we detected an outbreak there as well. So that has been our typical practice. Now, whether the entire school needs to be tested or whether it is just those who are identified as close contacts because of the cohorting and the pods that are in place, that's something that our infectious disease epidemiologists help us figure out after they've made contact with schools. But after we've determined that there is an outbreak, we do recommend in any setting that all close contacts be tested for COVID-19. That applies whether it's a school, a retail establishment, a restaurant, what have you. And that's guidance that we have adhered to ever since day one.
Andy, thanks for your question. I want to go to a question. This is an email from Bree. I am a home health occupational therapist working in rural communities that have recently tested positive for COVID-19 cases. I wear a mask and eye protector per my agency protocol, and attempt to keep a distance of 6 feet when able. My patients are not required to wear anything during clinician visits to their homes, and neither do household members. Please explain best practices for home health staff during these times of COVID.
Mm-hmm. Well, first, let me thank Bree for the work she does in home health, especially in times like this, when individuals may be reluctant or reticent to go visit their primary care provider. Having the option of getting their health care via a home health nurse or a home health aide is more important now than it ever has been. The best practices in those scenarios are, in practice, not really different from if the interaction were occurring in a healthcare facility, with one notable difference, which is that in a healthcare facility, it's sometimes a good bit easier to furnish the patient and their family members with face coverings. When you're going to someone's home, you may have to bring those with you. But in general, the best practice is for everyone involved in the interaction, the provider as well as the patient and the family members, to have a face covering on. What we've seen over and over again in the data is that where there are interactions and everyone has a face covering on, the likelihood of transmission from anybody to anybody else goes down very significantly.
Let's see. We will go from now to Ardina, who's calling from Hamden. Hi, Ardina. Go ahead.
Yes, I wanted to ask if it's in the purview of the Maine CDC to conduct some sort of public education on the correct wearing of face coverings. I've noticed that many of the face coverings are ill-fitting, and so I was just wondering if there would be some public education on that.
That's a really good point. I've noticed that myself as well, and I think this is a perfect opportunity to remind everyone of what some of the best practices and principles are of wearing a face covering. The face covering should be something that is tightly fitting enough to actually block particles, respiratory droplets, from exiting as you cough or maybe sneeze. So that means that the little piece that goes over your nose can't be straight. It's got to be molded around your nose to prevent air from escaping. The other really important piece is that to do its job, the face covering actually has to cover your nose. I see a lot of folks out there who have the face covering on but not covering their nose. I see another category of individuals who really look at the face covering as a little bit more as a chin strap. That is to say, it either covers neither their nose nor their mouth. If we want everyone to wear them. And we want everyone to wear them in such a manner that does something, that protects other people. The best way to do that is to make sure it fits snugly and that it covers both your mouth and your nose.
Thank you, Ardina, for your question. And we are going to go to another quick break. We're speaking with Maine CDC Director Dr. Nirav Shah. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from Eco Maine, reminding you to recycle, because when you do, you're helping create new, important, everyday items. EcoMaine.org. And Encore Renewable Energy, committed to fueling Maine's economic recovery with solar energy for businesses and institutions. Encore.eco.
Harriet Putnam Henry was born in Windham on September 28, 1923. She became Maine's first woman judge in 1973 in her appointment as judge-at-large for the district court system. Her expertise was in marine law and coastal management. She also has an extensive civil service record, including advocacy for women judges and work with child abuse and child welfare. She was active with the Maine Humanities Council, where the Harriet P. Henry Center for the Book was named in her honor in 2003. Henry retired from the district court in 1990. She died on September 11, 2004, at the age of 80.
On This Day in Maine's History was created in partnership with the Maine Historical Society and made possible through the generous support of Thomaston Place Auction Galleries and the Maine Maritime Museum. Happy birthday, Maine!
On the next Commonwealth Club program, get the inside stories of the Trump administration from two high-profile White House veterans. We'll hear from former National Security Advisor John Bolton and former Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders on the next Commonwealth Club radio program.
That's coming up in just a few minutes at 2 o'clock right here on Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. My guest, Dr. Nirav Shah, who is the head of the Maine CDC. We're talking about COVID-19 and the very latest. So many questions coming in. This one from Ayn in Sanford, and she is a Sanford City Councilor. Can you comment on Sanford's recent City Council decision to close parks, including fields for youth team sports, facilities for event rentals, basketball courts, skate parks, and playgrounds for community members? Many in our community are anxious to get our kids and neighbors back into our parks and onto city fields, but many of us are also concerned about stopping the growth of COVID in Sanford and are working towards getting our kids back to school. What would you tell us as a community?
Well, this is an example of where local control really does come into play. We understand the motivations that led to the members of the Sanford community going in that direction. And given the extreme increase of cases that we saw all around York County, but starting with their nucleus in Sanford, we understand where that impetus comes from to close areas of potential public gathering. I think the question will be, at what point can those restrictions be lifted? That is, I think, the harder question as you think about closing things. Closing things, in some respects, is just the first step. The second step is trying to set forth the preconditions under which we may reopen them. When it comes to things like parks, which have a valuable role in our community from a physical health perspective as well as a community gathering perspective, trying to figure out when we move forward with reopening those things, that is a more difficult question. That's something that we've been having some conversations with folks in and around Sanford about to help them navigate at what point it may be safe to reopen. And that's got to be part of the equation as well.
All righty. We're going to go to, Lawton, who's calling from Penobscot. Hi, Lawton. Go ahead.
Yes, Dr. Shaw, I wonder if you can address respiratory aerosol spray and what we've learned about how this virus is so effective traveling from one human's warm, moist respiratory tract to another. And is there any good educational tools? Like, I've seen Bill Nye, the science guy's demonstration on masks. Is there any good respiratory aerosol spray videos educationally you can think of for schools and churches and businesses that they may look at?
Lawton, what a wonderful question. This has been on my mind quite a bit, so I thank you for raising it. Here's the bottom line with respect to this entire business around aerosols. For a long time now, I'm talking decades, we have understood and known that the type of virus that causes COVID-19. It belongs to a family called coronaviruses, are predominantly transmitted through heavier respiratory droplets, but that they can also be transmitted through smaller droplets called aerosols. Aerosols can be emitted when we speak or sing. The droplets are more of what gets emitted when we cough or sneeze. And really, this has, I think, unfortunately been painted as a dichotomy. It's either all droplets or either all respiratories. And of course, in scientific matters, there are rarely clean dichotomies. It really is more of a spectrum. And as we learn more and more about COVID-19 transmission, we are developing a finer understanding that there seems to be more aerosol transmission than we previously accounted for back in January, February, or March. And thankfully, many of the recommendations that public health practitioners have been putting out, being outdoors as much as possible, introducing ventilation into places like buses, restaurants, schools, helps all of those things help reduce the likelihood that aerosols can form into a concentrated enough fashion and actually cause transmission. So you mentioned the possibility of having some sort of public communication. I haven't seen anything in my mind that really typifies this in a manner that makes it easy to understand and grapple with. So I think that maybe is something that, if it's not my agency, some agency out there needs to put out an easy to understand PSA that walks through the difference between droplets and aerosols and why that matters. I think the key there is why it matters. And in this setting, as our understanding evolves, it's all the more reason that we also focus not just on masks, but also on things like ventilation and things of that nature. Jennifer, I also wanted, before we turn to the next question, to issue a quick self-correction. During the break, I checked on a number that I mentioned a moment ago, and I wanted to issue a correction. I think I said that we had logged about 1 million test results in Maine. That's incorrect. I checked on our website, and the actual number is about 422,800 test results that have come back. I just wanted to make sure I was clear with everybody about what the actual number is.
Terrific. An email here from Mark. Question on the difference between positive tests in clinical cases and hospitalizations in Maine. Our death rate has slowed or dramatically decreased, has it not? Even as positivity has increased. And from other reports, hospitals around the country or large medical institutions, the metric of serious illness and death seems to indicate we are at a real low point. Is that true? And is it also the case in Maine?
It is true. It is the case in Maine. And it's a good sign. Much has changed in our understanding both of the disease as well as the management of that disease since the first cases were detected back in March. And I'm not just talking about in Maine, I'm talking about nationwide. And as a result of that, clinicians now have a finer sense of two questions. who must truly be admitted to the hospital in order to have optimum care? That's number one. And number two, what is the best way to care for those individuals after they've been admitted? Clinicians now have a finer sense that not everyone with COVID needs to be in a hospital. Back in March, we didn't really know all the facts. And so the default position to err on the side of safety was to admit patients. As a result of better and more understanding of the clinical trajectory of COVID patients, fewer and fewer patients need to be admitted to the hospital. That's a good thing. It does not mean that they are not sick. They are still sick, but they can be better managed or equally well managed at home. So that's one reason the number of individuals who have been admitted to the hospital has fallen nationwide, not just in Maine. It's also one reason why the number of individuals who have passed away has fallen, not just in Maine, but nationwide. Those are both good things. I did want to note that it does not seem to be connected to the positivity rate, which continues to fall in Maine. Our positivity rate right now is about 0.48% on a statewide basis.
We'll go to Vinny from Brownfield. Hi, Vinny. Go ahead.
I live in Brownfield, Maine, Oxford County, but far from Rumford. We're going to be having three public hearings on Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday of this week. They'll be indoors, but it's in a small gymnasium-type room with plenty of ventilation, windows and doors. But while masks are recommended, they're not required. And also, the meetings probably will go on for more than half an hour or plus. And I was wondering if there's any recommendations on that as far as time-wise on the meetings and if masks should be required.
It's a great question. We generally think of a contact in terms of the duration. We think of anything that occurs for 15 minutes or more within about a 6-foot margin as something that raises the possibility, the distinct possibility of transmitting COVID-19. In the setting that you're describing at the town meetings, which are, of course, important, I don't want to discount for a second the importance of town meetings, but it is possible that those meetings would, as you say, go on for more than 15 minutes, almost certainly, and individuals could be in close contact with one another. Now, things like ventilation, doors and windows open, fans running, those things can help. But the bulk of the work from a prevention standpoint is done by things like masks and physical distancing. So I think everyone who's attending that meeting should be wearing a mask. Whether they're required to or not, I think everyone should do so because it's the right thing to do and it's the healthy thing to do. It's the right thing to do for yourself, your family, and your community, and it's the healthy thing to do to keep yourself safe as well as to keep other people there safe.
Okay, we will go to Beth, who's calling from Harmony. Hi, Beth. Go ahead.
Thank you. I wanted to know how one trains a dog, a sniffer dog, to detect COVID-19. I heard a BBC report that they're using dogs at the Helsinki airport in Finland.
Yes, indeed. I myself heard that report, saw that report, and immediately started getting really curious. As a very fervent dog lover myself, I thought that was just a very interesting thing. You know, I think this is an example of the entirely interesting and potentially hidden skill sets that dogs can have in their service and their work with us. You know, the way that these things are trained and the way that the trainers train the dogs to go about that is downright fascinating. We obviously won't go into it now. But I think the bigger question is, what are the ways in which we can use unconventional or non-conventional approaches to thinking about COVID-19? Maybe it's through having dogs being more well-trained in order to sniff these things out. Maybe it's through completely new ways to think about testing and contact tracing. We're so early in our work with COVID-19 that there are more opportunities out there than I think any of us has potentially thought through. The use of dogs to help us out is just one great example of that, and a really charming, delightful example at that.
All right. A quick question here from Lori on Facebook. The identified outcome of the action of the state of emergency was to reduce the number of COVID cases to a manageable level. Now wondering, since it is obviously at a manageable level, where is the action leading? What is the intended outcome?
That's a question that my team and I think about a lot. You know, I think it's a way to think about that is to take stock of where we've come so far. We have successfully struck a balance in Maine between controlling COVID-19 and resuming and reopening various forms of economic and social activity. So right now, we're in a situation where we've been able to reopen most businesses safely, though not all. As we talked about earlier, Jennifer, we went through a tourist season safely, and we're now getting kids back into schools in varying and different ways. I think the view, my view is that back in March when we started this, we had to build the plane very quickly. We've not just built the plane, we've gotten it in the air, we've kept it in the air, and we're flying in the right direction. So now the question is, how and where are we going to land this plane? There are many different views and opinions on how and where we should go about that. Some of them involve potentially even waiting for a vaccine. None of that has been sorted out. I think the right call for us right now, though, is to recognize that we are headed in the right direction. And where we decide to land that plane, it may differ, and everyone will have a different viewpoint on that. But let's go into that discussion acknowledging the good work that Maine people have done in order to get us here. There are very few other states in the country that could even contemplate having that discussion right now. We have the luxury of being able to do so because of the good work that we've done so far in the state. I welcome a diverse set of opinions on what the endpoints here look like. But right now, again, let's just acknowledge that wherever we land, we're heading in the right direction.
All right. Earlier today, Dr. Shaw, we received this voicemail from Rick in Surrey.
Maine CDC contact tracers are never going to give you up. They're never going to let you down. They're never going to run around and desert you. Maine CDC contact tracers are never going to make you cry, they're never going to say goodbye, and they're never going to tell a lie and hurt you.
Dr. Shaw, we had to Rickroll you.
It seems perfectly justifiable, but let me take a moment to give a big shout out to our entire team of contact tracers. We've got over 100 people at Maine CDC whose full-time job it is to figure out what's going on with COVID. You know, we've talked a bit about the events of the wedding that transpired that started on August 7th in Millinocket, and now 178 cases and sadly 8 deaths associated with that wedding. Query how often events of that nature are occurring in other states everywhere around us, and whether in Maine our contact tracers were the ones who were able to piece together the pieces of that puzzle so we would see the full picture. It's unclear which is the more predominant story, but what I know is that it's because of the work of those contact tracers peeling back every layer of the onion and drilling down, that's why we have such a clear picture of all those transmission events. We wouldn't be able to be here where we are in our response without their amazing work, and I'm really, really thankful for them as a team.
Okay, and we are grateful that you took the time to be with us here on Maine Calling today. Dr. Shaw, thank you so much. Nirav Shaw, the director of Maine's Center for Disease Control and Prevention. An exciting programming note, beginning next Monday, October 5th, Maine Calling is moving to a new time. We will be heard at 11 a.m. each morning, Monday through Friday. Same interesting conversations, just a little earlier in the day. Starting next Monday, Maine Calling, 11 a.m. Nikki Shields ran the board today. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.